In this episode, we will explore IWC and watches in every way possible. All of the ways that IWC watches appear in the paddock, appear in the pit lane, appear on the track. We have you covered, and I have the man of the moment here, the CEO, Chris Granger-Eyre, to tell me all of the secrets. Welcome back to the show. My name is Andrew McCutcheon.
Good to be back. I'm Chris Granger, CEO of IWC.
That was that perfect segue. This is a podcast, a mini-series, Chris.
Yes, it is indeed. I mean, we're talking the background of IWC in Formula One, I think starting from our long-standing partnership with Mercedes-AMG, how we got into Formula One, all the watches and stories and episodes that came with it, and then culminating, hopefully, at some point with the Formula One movie, which is the big thing now in June.
We're nearly there, but we're not there yet, and we have a very tasty morsel between now and then, which is the episode that really digs into the watches of Formula One as they pertain to IWC. There have been some very notable, memorable watches over the journey since 2013 when the partnership started with Mercedes-AMG. And in this episode, we're going to touch on some of your favorites, some that are in front of us, and we'll do that torturous podcast thing where we describe watches that you can't see, but there is a YouTube version. If you just get desperate and think, I absolutely have to see what you're talking about, you can do that. And you'll be able to see us do what we're going to do right now, which is a wrist check, because this is still a watch podcast. Chris, what are you wearing?
So today I'm wearing the first ever team watch from IWC for the Mercedes-AMG Petronas Formula One team. This is the 2022 41mm Pilot's Chronograph Mercedes-AMG Petronas in that unique black and teal combination titanium case and that teal team strap. What about you?
That's really lucky because I am wearing the performance version. And I don't understand the difference. What is the difference between mine and yours?
Well, they basically marked two US inaugural Grand Prix. This was Miami 22, first ever Miami Grand Prix. And the one you're wearing is first ever Las Vegas Grand Prix in 2023. That is the main difference. No, it's not.
Mine's a lot shinier.
That's actually the first ever tachymeter scale version of the Pilot's Chronograph. So again, that's a 41mm chronograph in our unique Ceratanium material and durable all black material, scratch resistant like ceramic, fracture resistant like titanium with a tachymeter bezel, and then a really unique dial with inserted sub counters, high gloss 15 layer lacquer finish, and applied numerals. So beautiful combo. And then a little teal accent just to reference back to the team. And it's also an interesting evolution in CI because team back in 2022 was all out on the Petronas accent. Everything was in teal, quite dominant. And then there was quite a rebrand in their graphic design. And in 23, they came back and said, look, we want to be more black. And our accent color is going to be Petronas green, but we're going to be more black. So this dominant color in this watch is black.
So how do you describe, because I'm looking at the two watches and we are just jumping straight into the watches because that's what this episode's for. You might have even flicked to it for that reason. They're really different, aren't they, in terms of their aesthetics and the messages they're sending. Who are they for? How would you describe the wearer of this watch versus that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the original team watch came at a very unique moment. And we touched on that in the last episode, how the emergence of Formula One as an entertainment platform and Drive to Survive really changed the game, changed the viewership, changed the fans in Formula One. And I think really the first Miami Grand Prix was that first moment when that really sprang into action. And Miami, for me, was the first Grand Prix where the lifestyle around it became bigger than the motor racing itself. I'd never seen that before to that extent. And we were all there and it was really quite a whirlwind and stuff was happening. And I sort of realized at the time, but I didn't quite even fathom the magnitude of that shift in Formula One that just happened. There were fashion launches everywhere. There was entertainment, there was track driving, there was like, you know, drag racing, Formula One cars. There was a Will.i.am, a G-Class front end to GT four-door launch out on Ocean Drive. And all of a sudden this entire sort of visual identity of that Miami mood in the Miami signature colors became the thing that took over a lot of social media. And of course, we were extremely lucky that our team color, you know, that we were preparing for that season, it hit two trends. Three trends, really. A, it's a Miami color because Miami is turquoise, pink, light blue. That's what you see when you think Miami. And when you see watches that have been released around Formula One Miami since, there's a recurring theme, definitely.
Hi, Tudor.
other watch brands are available. then there's for sure this element of coming out of COVID and a huge interest in bright colors in watches that came at that moment in time. And then, of course, there was also a signature color in the turquoise light blue that is somewhat related to this Patronas color and not that dissimilar, which also had a massive moment. You know, and there were basketballs and sneakers being launched all in that color scheme.
Tiffany blue.
At about the same time. And I think all of these effects came together to make something that was designed to be the first ever watch that was not for a driver or team principal, but for the team and the mechanics and everybody in the garage. And all of a sudden, it hit that cultural moment where it just took off.
Mm.
And those 3-4 days at Miami Grand Prix, it was just...
I remember that.
I mean, I think back to that time. It was probably one of my favorite trips away with work, like, ever. And it was just like, it was also the only time where I can ever relate to this phrase, my phone exploded, when Lewis ended up wearing, what was it, 3 or 4 watches? 3 watches, I think, at the time, when he protested against the jewelry ban, and he came with all his jewelry and all the watches at the same time.
You can't make that up.
And that image obviously went all around the world. And I remember just texting Lewis. I was at a driving experience at the Concours Club with our AMG friends. When that image, and suddenly I just got like message after message after message, and I saw that on ESPN, Sky, on CNN, every media outlet had carried that image of Lewis with the 3 watches. And I just texted Lewis, said, thank you, whatever that was you just did, thanks a lot.
Do more of that.
That was the biggest watch ad we've ever had.
So Chris, the performance chronograph is a totally different look. I mean, again, I'm talking on very basics here, but this is something, is this a more expensive version, a more luxe version? It has the gloss dial. We have the ceramic bezel insert. Yeah. How does this fit into the family? This is just something I've never properly understood.
Yeah, no, you're not the only one. I mean, it's really the extension of the Pilot's universe for the first time going into something that is racing specific. Obviously, the tachymeter scale is something that not a lot of people actually use, but theoretically, it gives you a mile-kilometer average speed calculation if you observe the time. So you can theoretically lap time people with their average speed on that. Is something that is very specific to the racing universe and really speaks to the versatility of the base design of the Pilot's chronograph, which, yes, is for pilots of the sky, but this is really the translation of that formula into a tachymeter chronograph, making it a bit more specific to the world of racing. And this is really what happened with that micro series around the AMG and Patronas Formula One team partnership on that performance chronograph series.
Now, Chris, speaking of teal on the date and day indication of my performance chronograph, I do think of a friend, George Bamford, and it brings to mind an addition that happened, was it a month ago, a couple of months ago?
Yeah, Miami, just before Miami, yeah.
Yeah. It was a customized piece for George Russell that he unveiled with a beautiful photo shoot. But how did that involve, did that involve George at all? Because there was whispers around at the time that there was some way that you'd work together.
Well, it did actually, because we were starting to experiment with George Russell's racing color, which is actually this particular blue here, which is actually, you know, quite a lot quite bluer different than sort of the Patronas blue-green that we have on the other watches. And at the time, George Russell, that is, asked me to make some dial prototypes in his racing color. And in the interest of time, you know, the first person that came to my mind to make a dial like that is George Bamford, because I know he's very good at dial making and customizing dials. So, you know, he came to the rescue and actually made those dials for us. And the one that came out with the black indices, which actually fits the ceramic engineer automatic, we saw at Watches and Wonders, it absolutely looked great. And I sent it to George Russell and said, do you like it? He said, I love it. Yeah, could I have it for Miami? And I said, yeah, sure. And we put that watch together, and that's what you saw in the end in that photo shooting in Monaco and later on Miami.
Can we explore this more, Chris? Because again, I'm looking at you slightly flummoxed, because I would like you to group the watches, the IWC branded watches that would appear to someone looking in at Formula One.
Yeah.
Because not all watches are for all. For everybody. Can I have a watch that is worn by the crew, for example? I mean, there are obviously one-off pieces I'll never have, but as a spectator on this, these many types of watches, can you break it down for me?
Yeah, it's getting more and more complex as well. I think, you know, I obviously don't have the full entire F1 history on that, but I think the fact that these team watches are relatively new, I think it used to be mainly watches that were commissioned by drivers, which always come from the driver personalities going, look, I'd like to have a watch that's XYZ, you know, and that goes back all the way to Michael Schumacher. And before that, I'm sure there were many great examples of that. Right. Yeah. But for us, it really started with Lewis, and Lewis being so design-minded and so, you know, style-minded, that he always had very strong opinions on what he'd like to wear and how he'd like to present himself and all the rest of it. And I think the earliest parts of these collabs were really Lewis Hamilton watches and Lewis coming out with certain ideas of color codes and materials and asking us about certain things, and then us working out a way how we could turn that into editions that we could sell commercially, mostly done through charity contributions to his foundations and so on. Then you have the same effect with obviously the Toto watch, where, you know, if the driver has a watch, the boss doesn't have a watch. And then when you go along
that...
Did
Toto request it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And there's always, you know, between... There's always like friendly sort of, you know, oh, you've got a watch. Can I have a watch? Yeah, it's, there is that going on as well, between drivers as well, for sure. And then whose is more expensive? Whose is paying? You know, there's definitely that going on as well. And then you have the team watches, which are much more than the second phase, where it's really about creating more the team IP in a watch, which is much more aimed at team members, which used to wear all sorts of different IWCs, which I never liked a lot. And when I first walked into the garage, it was like a huge hodgepodge of, you know, 20 generations of IWC. And I thought, well, you know, they have nicely curated outfits all the way down to belts and trainers. Can't we have a team watch, right? And this is when this project came along. And then, as you say, there is a version, and this is not actually a full watch version. This is simply the team branded strap that we put on team watches only, that was never for sale, and then a civilian version, as it were, without the big branding. And the big branding on the watch straps is always for television, always to make sure that we get some sort of branding on TV. Mm-hmm. So that's the team watch element. And then there's the one-offs, and the one-offs is really when there is some sort of idea, and I usually get either a WhatsApp voice note or a text with something somebody's seen somewhere. So this could be Toto saying, I have a new phone cover, Lewis saying, free painted my jet, or, you know, something like that. And can't we do burgundy, or can't we do, you know, antifreeze yellow was the color of a moment for some time. We made many iterations in antifreeze yellow. Or, you know, as it were, burgundy and gold for Lewis, or later on this sort of peacock teal color that he really was into personally. And then there was a moment when Toto liked that Petronas teal green color an awful lot, and you know that's when how we ended up with a full watch in that color for Vegas, or indeed back in 2022 when Lewis's race suit changed to black and the livery changed to black, and he texted us, said, look guys, can we do a matching watch, can you do an all black? And then the IWC movie set department springs into action and makes watches that don't exist in no time at all. And when you look at that blacked out Big Pilot perpetual calendar ceramic, this was actually a ceramic watch with a Ceratanium bracelet, not from this watch, that was glued into the watch case lugs. The dial was spray painted at IWC in the backyard, black, and I think we used a Sharpie for some of the hands. So in the end, because you had like a 48-hour window to deliver this watch to wherever it went. So yeah, these are same as we did for Top Gun or F1 movie. These are things that are put together to create a visual effect, sometimes really, really quickly. And then, you know, actually Lewis would say, "I, you know, this has come off and that has come off, and can you come and fix it?"
Look, if you've stuck with us this far through this episode and through the first two, I feel like you are someone we can trust. Mm. And I feel like whatever I say now is going to be completely held in confidence. But there is someone in the room who will routinely message me and say, "Andrew, you didn't get this from me, but this watch might just be about to appear in the paddock." And I'll be like, wow, what are the chances that I'll get that tap on the shoulder? Because all of these things...
Political spin doctors, huh?
I think of, and I just think, I remember getting a message about that old black watch and how this... And of course, the same way that people will... And I have to ask the question. I can't believe I didn't at the time, but the George Russell watch. Of course, the question is then, well, can I get my old black... my fully blacked out stealth Big Pilot? Can I get my Tiffany blue dial black ceramic engineer? Answer that question. Is that George Russell watch ever going to be in production?
Not decided yet.
Oh, I feel that we've let our trusted confidant down. I've built them up.
You may have a bit of sway over this, actually, depending how you play it in this episode.
Okay, exactly. Well, look, I don't know where the comment section is. Go to YouTube, actually. Marcus is winking at me. Go to YouTube and tell us if that would... but I certainly know from our Instagram, Time and Tide was on fire with yep, would buy, would buy, would buy, smash or pass, smash, smash, smash. Mm. It was a winner. So I suppose it's a bit of a chance to innovate and to try new things, but it's really quite
yeah,
funny and sometimes to hear of the
it's always
the magic
a blend of things. You know, sometimes things also cannot be done, like that full Petronas colored one we did for Toto. You know, there is no, you know, technical solution for that in the universe at the moment. And to develop that color in ceramics will take like 3 years and costs quite a bit of money. So sometimes it's just also not feasible. But it's also a nice test bed for ideas sometimes, for sure. And I always say, look, with Lewis as well, these are all watches. That Portuguese, you know, tourbillon chronograph that we did with Lewis with the diamonds on the dial and full platinum.
The retrograde chronograph, 44.
Yeah, exactly. You know, these are watches that him nor us would have made on our own, like, ever. It's really that crossover between Lewis's taste and ideas and our sort of, you know, brand DNA sort of limits, and you meet somewhere in the middle, right, with many iterations on the way. And I think that's really interesting because it's projects that we would have never done on our own, like, ever in a million years. So that's why I'm grateful to those kind of influences, right?
And let's talk about, because I must admit to you, dear listener, that I had a little peek at Chris's phone as we unpicked this George Russell, George Bamford conspiracy. And I saw the tone of the conversation, and it was a very excited George.
I didn't show you that.
Yes, you did. You're very excited, George Russell. Lots of exclamation marks. Just, you know, this isn't an excited watch lover being shown a glimpse of a modified watch. What are the drivers like to work with in terms of, and how do the ideas come in? Because I suppose we now have, has Kimi hit you up yet for anything for himself?
Yeah,
so I feel that he's earned the right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an interesting trajectory, which we've seen with all of the drivers so far, that this really comes over time. Like in the beginning, I think drivers get to know their sponsors, get to know the partners, and it's all kind of very corporate in the beginning, because you're promoting an energy drink, tomorrow an LED lighting solution, and after that some hedge fund, right? So it's quite overwhelming. You think like somebody
World.
You know, Mercedes team probably have what, 26 sponsors? I mean, I'm making this up, but something in that sort of range. And it's an awful lot of PR work and shaking hands and paddock club. And of course, every CEO and leadership team is like, you know, we're special and I should have time with the drivers, etc. So in the beginning, it's just a getting to know each other. Mm-hmm. But because we make a consumer product that is on your wrist, and because drivers interact with this watch quite a bit, I think there comes a time in every sort of relationship journey, if they like RWC, there will be the moment where they say, well, actually, you know, I have an idea. Why couldn't we? And this always comes. And Kimi obviously is first season. He's completely new to the game. We've actually launched that 40 millimeter automatic, on his wrist, that team version of the automatic. But that time will come when we suddenly have the conversation at some event sideline where he says, you know what, I would really like on this. I find this very, very inspiring every time, because it always comes out of some very practical consideration, or even, you know, in some cases, what family members have said to them, what they've seen somebody else wear. And it's always a very, very interactive process. And it takes 2 years plus. I mean, Toto watch, yeah, more than 2 years. Lewis's watch typically up to 2 years, just design discussions back and forth.
The Cerulean ever going to make it to production?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, that's cool.
Well, I mean, not this one, but another one.
Staying on Kimi, I was lucky enough to attend the Melbourne Grand Prix earlier this year, and I was staying at the Ritz-Carlton, which was Kimi's hotel, and I ran into...
I feel we're disclosing a lot of information here.
it stays above board.
It's not there anymore.
Well, I do. It does get a little unusually intimate, and this is what I didn't expect about the hotel.
If now the next word is steam room, I'm getting worried.
No. It's above board. It is the gym, which is pretty next to the steam room, so we're close. But I was shocked that the drivers would just be eating in the same. There was Carlos Sainz. There was a bunch of drivers. Yeah. It wasn't just the Mercedes team. But I noticed that Kimi in the gym, very lightweight work. He's not a big unit right now. But
have you tried to fit into a Formula One seat? I mean,
that's true. You don't. It's not for bulking. The profession. But he spent so much time. He was bouncing it. His training partner was bouncing a tennis ball off a wall from behind him, so he didn't know where it was going to go, and he had to react. And watching him do that for 45 minutes, I'd finished my workout long ago, but I just had to keep pretending I was doing stuff. So I used a treadmill, which is just doesn't ever happen because I just
backwards.
Just with a newspaper with the eyes cut out from it. Anyway, I was just watching Kimi and I was thinking, this is because at that point it was before his first race. So his first race proper. So I didn't know whether he'd be. And in that same weekend, I spent a lot of time with Liam Lawson, who sort of rose and then fell and then has re-risen after, was it the Spanish Grand Prix that he did well last weekend? I think he was top 10. Maybe the weekend before in Monaco, he was top 10. But Liam's bounced back again. But you never know. I didn't know whether Kimi would be someone I'd ever speak of again or whether it was going to be one of those occasions where I was like, oh, I spent time in the gym with this guy. And they'd be like.
And he became nine times Formula One champion.
Exactly. It could be anything. Yeah. But I just remember watching him thinking, wow, the being close to these drivers is really interesting. But do you have any anecdotes of being super close to these drivers in terms of, you know, what are the traits of success that you see in them, the ones that make it, the ones that are, because George is having a fantastic year, George Russell.
Yeah.
You know, I was lucky to spend time with him again through IWC, but I'm so curious about the what drives these people and the habits that they have. And in this case, Kimi, it's just all about tennis balls bouncing off a wall. 45 minutes.
Yeah, and you can see a lot of that when you walk down the pit lane, actually, and you see in the garages a lot of these coordination and reaction speed exercises of bouncing, catching, dropping tennis balls, the good old, you know, drop test, this kind of stuff they do a lot of. But what I find really fascinating with Formula One drivers is obviously most of them come from karting. They've had a long sort of racing career. So the discipline in the racing and getting into the zone and delivering this consistency lap after lap is something that is fascinating, but I find understandable. I get that I could never do it, but when you see, like, when they used to tell Lewis Bonner over the radio and say, okay, next lap, can you bring your front left tire temperature down by 0.2 of a degree? Then he knows how to modify his cornering to deliver exactly that temperature change in the front left tire on the inside of the tire. And you go like, wow, you know, I wouldn't even be able to hit the same line around this corner three times in a row, let alone doing it 54 times with people trying to overtake you, undertake you from every direction, with you not being able to see anything 30 meters in front of your car, going at 200x miles an hour, and delivering that sort of nuanced performance. That's incredible. The focus, the concentration they need for that, wow. But what really, really I find very, very fascinating, as they're growing their profile in Formula One, and Kimi is right at this point right now, they suddenly need to become ambassadors of all sorts, spokespeople, inspiring sport legends, interview professionals, PR people, personal brands, business people, all of this other stuff. And all of a sudden, they have to go from being at a Corporation XYZ PR event and doing 600 selfies with customers in the paddock club, delivering a speech on, you know, their development in Formula One, and the next minute go into that zone where they're in the garage, suit on, helmet on, and go time to deliver that amount of, in when you've just traveled, been on an aircraft, have your tummy all over the place because your nutrition has changed, different food, different time zone, jet lag, you know, a hotel bed you don't like, all the rest of it. You know, nothing against Ritz-Carlton, I'm sure it's great. But you know, that versatility of snapping in and out, and then they've had a really, like Lewis as well, you can see sometimes, yeah, really bad session out on track. And then walking into the motorhome and needing to be all smiles for the next PI event, you know, and the next photo shooting 2 minutes later, and then going onto an IWC fashion shoot in a studio somewhere, completely new crew he's never met. You know, it's like that versatility and professional discipline, I find I can really admire.
Because they're so young. I mean, Kimi is so young to be able to master that. I mean, I'm not young and I have something life experience, but that reality that you just outlaid there.
It would throw us,
out completely.
Yeah.
I think my life's tough. That's definitely, and there's 20 something sponsors for every brand. So you're going from peppy jeans to
vitamin water. Plus the rappers that are coming along. Then they do projects, you know, like you see with Marriott as well. And George Russell has to do some acting in a, you know, arriving in a hotel and helicoptering to the track and doing a bit of comedy. Then Lewis has to do a drag race with with Glenn Powell's jet down the Amazon airport runway out in Texas. You know, so the versatility of what they have to do in a day, you know, then attend the parties, back to the next shooting, then get him back in the zone, watching your nutrition, not being able to eat or drink at events. I mean, wow, take some discipline that.
And do you find that in the same way that for us in our relatively busy lives, that watches are our happy place in many ways? It's the place that we, even sometimes looking at a nice watch can give me a moment of respite from the attack of my life. But do you find that the, even though they, as you say, that some of them come into it not being into watches, it's just another product in their mix, and then it ends up being this thing, but that they end up, you invariably get the WhatsApp message from the driver saying, hey, Chris, just wondering, if you ever thought about this and this, is do you find that the hobby is it's different to other sponsors because it's a bit more of a, the connection that the drivers have with RWC is more personal, the watch is on them, but it also, for many men in particular, it is a happy place. Do you find that transition happens too?
Yeah, it does happen for sure. And it comes with that territory of, I still think when I try to think about why is that the way it is because watches are one of the most compact carriers of symbolism that we have in our wardrobe, in our arsenal, especially for men, you know, in the absence of jewelry and other accessories, that really is the one thing that can say a lot about your beliefs, what you're into, what you like. It's always a conversation starting point. And it's also one of these only transmissional products that you would actually pass on to your son or daughter later on in life, you know, where every little dent and scratch and every little, you know, kink in a strap and whatever it may be becomes part of your story. It reminds you of, oh yeah, this is where I crashed my mountain bike and I ended up with that scratch. And it becomes part of your story. And I think this makes the product uniquely emotionally loaded compared to many other things. I don't relate to a pair of shoes in that way or to a suit jacket or anything else. But a watch is very, very powerful little emotional storyteller. And I think this is also why when people come into contact with watches, especially pilots and drivers, even if they haven't been avid watch collectors or very much into watches, sooner or later, they'll start liking this type of machine. They start thinking about it and they start watching what their friends are wearing, other drivers are wearing, and it becomes a conversation point. And I think this is, yeah, it's probably quite unique to our kind of business and why you find that when people are exposed to it, sooner or later, they have an opinion.
So. I just love all that. And when people say to me, Andrew, you were a general journalist, how could you go so deeply into one subject? I say, it's because of your speech just now. That's why. Because it isn't. Watches are uniquely personal, and as you said,
you did general journalism. I didn't know that before.
Watches. Yes, no. I published a book about Thai cooking. I published a book about guitars. I published.
Oh, see, there's a rabbit hole. Next mini series, Thai cooking. I want to learn to cook better. I'm horrible.
I have a guy for you. Yeah, he's in Melbourne. There's a restaurant called Chin Chin in Flinders Lane in Melbourne, and it is one of the Thai restaurants of global fame. Yeah. There's always a queue around the block for it, and it's because Ben and the team at Chin Chin just pack so much flavor punch, as well as like it's this crazy sort of anime style aesthetic. And we did a great cookbook for them. But no, I am not
always, I always think of Melbourne very fondly in food dimension terms because first time I ever came to Melbourne, and this is the most obvious thing to do, it's like Bondi icebergs in Sydney, but people took me to Stokehouse and Kilda, and we stopped there for lunch, and this was hands down one of the best lunches I've ever had in my entire life. And I don't know what went on there that day, but everything they served was just perfection.
Yeah.
And the vibe and the sun and just everything was like...
Why would I leave all that for London? That's now you're making me miss home. But no,
there's restaurants in London too.
we move the story now to the attributes of RWC watches and what makes them suitable for the task of being driver's watches.
Yeah.
And watches that have the things you need as a driver or as a pit lane crew or as a principal. Because if I think about it, and this is one of those really simple, sometimes the simplest revelations are the ones that hit you the hardest and the latest. But it just occurred to me that pilots' watches have certain attributes that make them very practical for pilots. Mm. But talk to me about the ways that motorsport timing and motorsport is a good fit for RWC and its design language. Obvious question.
Obvious question, obvious answer. It's all about the clock, you know, the stopwatch never lies. No, I think you're absolutely right. But I think that emotional connection really goes quite deeply. And it's not a very superficial story at the end of the day, because, you know, these watches, especially RWC watches, they've always been tool watches. At their heart, they're instruments for a purpose back in the day. First pilot's watch from RWC in 1936. First Portuguese navigation watch 1939. And that was even after there were deck observation watches watches, etc. First chronograph, 1870s, built by a Swiss watchmaker in New York on top of that Jones movement and so on. So all these watches, they are derived from needing to be precise, legible, robust. You can bang them about and they do their job. They're the ultimate navigation backup instrument. And of course, it's absolutely clear nobody really needs that in their practical lives today. However, for example, when we sponsored the Silver Spitfire around the world flight in 2019, Matt Jones was the principal pilot of the Spitfire. He was actually somebody who had a situation where he lost his electronic navigation computer on board the Spitfire on the way to an airshow display. And he made a habit of always setting off his chronograph when he left base to have the timing and bearing, to have a rough idea of where he is in case all of the navigation instruments fail him. And this is actually what happened to him on that one flight. And he relied on time and speed to get to the rendezvous point to start the air show, which he did, was on time, was there, knew where he was, and flew the thing completely visual with complete instrument blackout. And yes, the likeliness of you needing that as a pilot is 0.0001%, but it still represents that on your wrist. If all else fails, you have this, the stars, your line of sight, and your airspeed, and you can navigate, right? And I think this is why for pilots in particular, and then to, you know, racing drivers as an extension, these things are such a powerful statement that even in the world, you look at all our, you know, professional jet pilot colleagues nowadays. Yes, they may wear a fully electronic smartwatch with all the G meter and oxygen saturation, all the rest of it on one wrist, but they will always, always, always love the mechanical watch on the other wrist because of the storytelling, because of the meaning, because of the emotion, because of the status of being a pilot and all the swagger that comes with it. First time we went to Top Gun in Fallon, I came with all the designs together with Christian Knoop, who you know very well, and we had all of our sort of, you know, subdued tactical designs with us. And they were looking at us, these guys at Top Gun, said, no, 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 we like our baby blue signature color. Can we have a Santoni Italian leather strap? Can we have baby blue contrast stitching? We made a Top Gun instructor watch now with diamonds on the dial, you know, because there is so much storytelling, so much elegance, so much appreciation of the finer things in life. You know, you look outside Top Gun and Fallon, you see vintage muscle cars, vintage Corvettes, you know, 69 fastback Mustangs, you know, that kind of stuff. These people, they love beautiful objects and they love, they're very proud of what they do. And I think racing drivers are just like that. And that's why, of course, you can say today, you're not going to use a tachymeter scale to you know, calculate average speed. I mean, we have the top-notch maths and statistics and physics going into these systems that Formula One teams operate on. Nobody needs that. But it's a reminder of the origins of all of this. And it's a true representation of the essence of what racing is all about. And I think that's why. Long-winded answer. Sorry about that.
Well, I did ask the question, and I think that there's sometimes that just some branding just feels off. It just doesn't feel authentic. Yeah. And I think that what I'm getting at there is just that there are many brands that could sponsor do sponsor Formula One teams, and the fit's just, you can always get a sense for how snug the fit is. Whereas I find that because by and large pilots' watches are super legible. That's their main attribute. At a glance, you need to be able to see where you are.
And they contain a stopwatch.
So these are things that are handy. The other place that watches appear, and I'm picking up a glove here in Formula One that relate to IWC, are the watches on the gloves. Yeah. I have to know this story. Were you the first to do it?
I think so, yes. And I think the story goes that we employed a gentleman in our partnership team named Jan Lefort, and he had come from Formula One directly. And as far as I know, and this is the version of the story that I know, he had this idea originally. And we were, I think, the first ones to print the watch on the gloves, which has reappeared quite a few times since. But I think, yes, it was his original idea as far as I know.
It's a really cool thing.
Put it in the comments if you know otherwise.
There's an art to sponsoring a team, and there's an art to displaying your logo in tactical places. Is there anywhere else that you've innovated there that you can share?
Well, it was the other one was definitely the Halo branding. And then I think the next iteration of that will come across when we do the episode on the F1 movie, which is that chin position on the helmet, which is definitely new because of the reversing cameras. I mean, this one here, this is all designed for the onboard cameras. When that really became a thing on television, that we had the air duct onboard camera, you suddenly had a view of the driver's hands, and you had a view of the halo when it came in, and so forth. So everyone went crazy for the halo branding, and then Formula One.
Explain
TV.
The halo. That's that little thing in front of.
So the halo is that roll cage element that actually protects the driver's head in case there is some violent flipping of the car going on. And obviously, from the second when we first saw this element. And we were presented it, and obviously, you know, aesthetically, everybody hated it, right? So it's a new safety feature. Here we are. It's called the Halo. And I was like, you're going to stick this on a car permanently? And they're like, yeah, it's going to be there forever. I was like, oh, wow. But the second thought that every sponsor had was, hang on a minute, you can see this in the onboard camera view. It's like right in the middle of the TV screen. So why don't we brand it? And like every partner went after that Halo position, only for Formula One to outsmarten us and actually put like the rev indicator all over that Halo branding. So there's basically a permanent sort of TV screen instrument panel that covers all of the branding on the Halo. So that went out of the equation a little bit. But the glove branding always worked because the drivers, the way they steer, you know, you have that sort of full lock just here. You get beautiful on every single right turn. You get a beautiful full watch display. And on every left turn, you get the RWC logo display. So this has not been obscured yet and has worked ever since. And we're very happy to have it.
I'm going to give you that free hit because it is something that is certainly, as someone that watches Formula One, I am more and more aware of every new spot something yeah. has a sponsor yeah, logo yeah. on it. Now, I have a very tough
They're
question.
Running out of space.
I think so.
Now by the left knee.
I have a very tough question to finish this episode with, but I'm going to put it to myself too. What is your favorite IWC Formula One related watch of all time? One only.
I would have to say, it, again, might be a bit of an obvious answer, but I have to say that it's the Toto Wolff shock absorber because of the background story and because of the reality of the storytelling behind and the fact that Toto is somebody who has some unique likes. He likes the sporty big watches and he likes things that glow at night. He likes it a lot. Luminescent, fluorescent, whatever it may be, he loves. And the combination that we obviously had this obvious background story where he wore the Ceritanium double chronograph during that episode in Saudi, which went quite viral. And, you know, it became sort of our joke. They said, well, the headset didn't do so well, but the watch survived. So, and we were just developing the shock absorber at the time. I said, Toto, why don't I make you a shock absorber just for you? And he said, yeah, can I have the spring in the teal color? And then he came with, can it glow at night? And obviously this is a BMG spring. The last thing you want to do to a BMG spring is
BMG
to coat
is it with
metallic glass. Yeah. The last thing you want to do to that is coat it with anything, because the minute you touch a BMG element, it marks dense scratches. It's an incredibly sensitive material. And the challenge to our engineers to make this green and to make it night luminous just for Toto's enjoyment, no functional purpose whatsoever, was like the toughest engineering challenge in the whole thing. And the fact that you now have a watch that survives 30,000 G impact, and we Toto tested, you know, maximum acceleration you can generate whacking the desk is about 1,500 G, so we're good with the 30,000 G. And to give this such a personal note and to finally be able to launch it in that colorway is just, yeah, I think that's my favorite.
Well, you kind of stole mine, because that was in the first episode. I showed Chris an episode of, a copy, an yeah. edition of the new Vanity Fair magazine, in which I called that my favorite modern concept watch. So you kind of took that off me, but it wasn't mine anyway.
What's yours?
My favorite is definitely the Ceralume, and it was because of the stir it caused on social media.
Yeah.
This is such a visual and easy to understand concept.
Yeah.
A watch that looks dangerously radioactive
yeah.
On, I think it was Lewis's wrist.
Yeah.
That was at Monaco, I think.
Yeah. There's two backstories to that.
Okay. What can you give me? Because it blew up social. So many questions. Mm. Most of them, oh my God, can please make that real.
Yeah.
But tell me the backstories, because that's what this is about.
Yeah. So there's two interesting nuggets here. Number one was the idea for Ceralume really came from my first ever visit to a company in Appenzell in Switzerland called Tritec, which have the patent for Swiss Superluminova. So all of the Swiss watch Superluminova that you see on your watches is from this company called Tritec. And the guy who runs it, Albert, he gave me the tour around the facility. It's a very small outfit, right? Because the entire Swiss watch industry doesn't use a ton of this stuff. You know, it's such minuscule amounts. And the first thing that I thought was incredibly cool is they have an aircraft hangar in the back where they have a whole aircraft museum and collection, like half buried in the ground, basically next to their facility, which is obviously wild, you know, and you have all these like Booker aircraft, they're super cool. And then I walked through the bit where they're actually sintering the superluminal material.
What is sintering?
Which is the heat treatment part of any ceramic-based material, right? So normally it gets processed in powder form, and then it gets heat treated in a special sort of heating up and cooling down, usually like with some gas component as well. And I saw this dish that contained almost like, it looked like the blocks to build the pyramids out of, this luminous material, like a ton of it. And it obviously glows like crazy at night. And I thought, this is not dissimilar to what we see in the ceramic process. And I said to Albert at the time, could we blend it? Could that become a solid material for a watch? And he said, well, possibly, maybe, who knows? I said, we never tried. And then we set off our apprentices on their apprentice challenge, which is the final project they have to do in their apprenticeship. And we challenged them to find a way to make a fully luminous ceramic case.
This was in the end white
zirconium oxide, because I researched, and again, all of the luminous stuff you see in watches mostly is plastic or plastic-based. I mean, they call it polymer or something posh, but it's plastic, right? And so we blended white zirconium oxide ceramic with just superluminova in a way to get that to be stable, to sinter it in a way that it remains stable and it becomes fully luminous. And then you have to machine it, which is an absolute nightmare. And the apprentices, they tried and they tried and they tried. And I will never forget, they came into my office and said, we cracked it, we got it, we got it, we got it. And then they had a presentation in the afternoon and they came in and they presented a snapped case as the final project. They said, we almost got there.
Oh.
Not quite, we almost did it. And that alone I found so inspiring, because these, you know, they're 18, 19 years, they're so passionate and they tried and tried and tried, they couldn't quite get there. And then we spent another year to industrialize it a bit more after this challenge, and we got there in the end, and we had the first case, and this is what you see in this heirloom chronograph that we launched in Monaco. And at the time of the launch, there's this really strange place in Hamburg called Miniature Wonderland. And it's basically a huge theme park based on model railway scale installations and rebuilds of all sorts of environments. And they were launching a full-size railway scale version of the Monaco Grand Prix just before the Monaco Grand Prix. And they actually got Prince Albert to attend the opening of this mini Monaco. And you have all the cars going around. And they are huge on Instagram, by the way, and YouTube with their videos.
I think I saw someone visit it and do a TikTok story about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they have this full Monaco Grand Prix. And obviously, they have day, night, and night mode in Miniature Wonderland. So we sent one of our colleagues there with a watch. And they actually placed the watch onto one of the billboards along Monaco Grand Prix. And as you see the video of this miniature land in Hamburg, you will see that Ceralum watch in day mode and then in night mode glowing up as the little Formula One cars are going past. And then that was sort of the launch story. And then Lewis wore it, obviously, in the paddock. So it existed in real life and in the, you know, miniature version of Monaco Grand Prix at the same time.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are the stories that would simply not exist if we hadn't have taken this time. Chris, thank you for another episode of Behind the Scenes Stories. And I just feel like there's no end to them.
Probably not. Thank you for having me.
In whichever direction we drive. So stay with us. There will be an episode 3, and this is where things get real. We start talking about one of the movies of the year. Have you seen it yet, Chris?
No, I haven't. Still not. No.
Do you believe him, Marcus? No.
I actually haven't seen it, and I've been asked numerous times to come out to LA and watch it, but I just can't make it work at the moment. So I'll see it in London at the official
premiere. On the 26th?
24th, I think it is. 3rd? 3rd. 23rd in London. I'll see it.
There you go.
Can't wait.
We are all in the same position then, if this is publishing
George
before.
Russell has seen it.
George Russell has seen
all
it.
The Formula One drivers.
Let's call him. You've got his WhatsApp. Thanks for listening. We will see you on the next episode. And more to come. IWC takes on Hollywood.
See you next time.